Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets where more all-time highs were hit. He takes a look at crude, gold, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Founder of Armstrong Economics, Martin Armstrong, joins us from Florida. He talks about his new book, The 2024 Outlook, The Year from Political Hell. He gives us his take on the markets, housing, global debt bubbles, and what would happen if the U.S. refuses to pay its debt to China. The president of InsideTrackTrading.com, Eric Haddock, examines the cycles connected to the U.S. dollar, interest rates, Bitcoin, real estate, and gold, and does he think gold has the best chance of a major upside this year? We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
How would you describe what happened on the markets this week?
This is a go-with-the-flow kind of market, isn't it? The big-cap weighted indices, the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Dow are all making all-time highs. What do we got? We're up 6% year-to-date on the S&P, and that's because of these big names that are out there. But if you look at the unweighted index, it is actually unchanged on the year. So this is one of those ones where you want to, as I say, go with the flow, recognize where the activity is, and be there. The seasonals are, buy when it snows and sell when it goes. Well, right now, I guess if you're in Eastern Canada, you still got the snow. And this market has just got more legs in it than enough as far as the big cap names are concerned. So, the thing you look for at the top is either just upside exhaustion, and we're seeing some of that, but ideally you want to see rolling tops, and at this point every high is becoming progressively higher. The pullbacks are becoming progressively smaller and at better levels. So as long as the trend is in motion, you stay with it, recognizing that yes, there are excesses out there, but enjoy it while the parade is on right now.
What's going on with crude?
We're going through that basing activity since the middle of December, and things heating up a little bit down in Israel and with Hamas. So we got a little bit on the upside this week, closing up around 76.5. So this is, it's in this trading range of 71 to 79. And seasonality would suggest that with now this nicely tested low in the first week of February, that we should be ready to take out that resistance at 79. And the stocks, if you take a look at them, the XLE as an ETF, is showing a little bit of buoyancy there. So maybe this has finally got a chance to break out of this base that we've been into for the last, 8 weeks or so now. So playing this one from the long side and just looking for it to gain some momentum.
What's going on with gold?
About the same that's happening in the dollar. It's just the currencies and the gold market doing virtually nothing here. Stuck in trading ranges, the Gold has been sort of the upper end, lower end of this range for the last month and a half now. Seasonality is running out of favor, so we're going to have to just watch to see how it breaks out of the trading range. The miners have not been doing very well. If you take a look at the GDX, you can see that the mining indices not doing that well. And for leadership, that would suggest maybe that gold is going to break down through that 2,000 level on the spot price. We'll see how it does. But for now, you know, there's not a lot to write home about there.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar had that nice little pop to the upside a week ago. It's held those gains, but really not managed to do much, much more. Canadian dollar stuck in its trading range, so not a lot in as far as that one is concerned. There's really no leadership happening in here. And if you take a look at interest rate spreads between U.S. and Canada, there's nothing there to drive the money in or out of Canada. Just a flat line as far as that one's concerned. You know, you've got these U.S. yields. The 30-year is up around 4.4%. The 10-year is about 4.2%. And if anything, they're look as though they might have a little bit of a pop to the upside in the next week or so. But there's nothing, no driving force in there. The big market that's on the go right in this last few days, independent of the stock market, has been Bitcoin. Bitcoin had that good retracement rally in the early part of this year, retraced about 60% of the decline from the two-year high, got up around 48,000 triple five, and then backed off a little bit here. We got a nice oversold reading about 10 days ago, both in terms of our springboard reading and also in terms of the sequential. We got a sequential buy setup in there, and we've had a nice little pop. We're back retesting the highs that we put in back two months ago now. And if anything, looks as though it's poised to break out on the upside.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Always good. Nice to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Martin Armstrong next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, available online at armstrongeconomics.com. He's speaking to us from Florida. Marty, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You have a new book out called The 2024 Outlook, The Year from Political Hell. Can you tell us about it and where people can get it?
Well, it's downloadable at our site. People, and I don't think they realize, but about 60% of the entire world is going to election this year. It's not just the United States. I mean, you've got major elections everywhere. I mean, even the head of Europe is up for election. Putin's up for election. I mean, it's quite amazing. And we're getting an awful lot of people starting to show resistance against the current administrations in a lot of places. There was a new study that just came out, which even shocked me, that they have now declared that Trump actually won the 2020 election. And the thing that I was really kind of surprised about, they said that over 40% of all the votes were mail-in. And they conducted a study of the people that supposedly mailed in ballots, and they said about you know, 20% of them are all fraud. Everywhere you go, it's just getting to the point where, I don't know, I mean, if anybody trusts government anymore. There's a new study out in Europe that the confidence in the European government has fallen to 30%. I think 2024 is the year from political hell.
Did you watch the Tucker Carlson Vladimir Putin interview this week where they discussed Ukraine, China, neo-Nazis, the CIA, propaganda, the U.S. dollar, and Putin's views on the United States?
Yes, I did. And I found Putin very, very restrained. He could have said a lot more, but did not. I think really that what is significant about it is that all of mainstream media refused to even show it. Why? You know, it's all propaganda. No, they're the ones spreading the propaganda. I've put out a book myself. I mean, I have very good sources, and I was in the middle of a whole attempt to take over Russia in 2000. And, I mean, that was basically a attempt to take it over using a guy named Boris Novsky. And perhaps you'll recall of, you know, a couple of years ago when this whole, you know, Hillary thing was contrived, oh, Putin interfered in the election and all this nonsense, he stood up alongside of Trump and said, fine, you want to come and, you know, investigate, question any Russians, go right ahead. He says, I would like to question Bill Browder. And, of course, in the Senate, everybody jumped up. No, we can't ever question an American, blah, blah, blah. They all knew it was a fake. And people have to understand this. So what came out of the investigation was, yes, Hillary paid for this fake dossier, but who gave it to the FBI? It was McCain, a Republican. I mean, you know, people are beginning to realize there's just a uniparty down there. And when it comes to certain things, there is no difference. You know, it's just quite shocking, really. Even this last attempt, to put it in perspective, I mean, they were criticizing Trump before. Oh, he wants to build a wall. That will spend $1.2 billion. What a waste of money. Just this tranche, they want to give, Ukraine $118 billion. I mean, we're approaching $1 trillion. On what? You know, the joke in town in Washington, that they don't want to say on TV, but the joke is that the Biden administration has created more billionaires than any other in history. Problem is, they're all in Ukraine.
We have some listener questions. The first one's from Dan. When there are no institutional buyers of residences, will it cause a recession, and what would that recession look like?
Well, the institutional buyers in, I assume he means property, real estate, they're not really as pervasive as a lot of people think. They are going after, they're changing the laws and going after real estate purchases now. Janet Yellen is, you know, going after people who want complete details of every company, where you live, if you move, you got to tell the government. I mean, this all reminds me of East Germany when I went behind the Berlin Wall. But a lot of people are trying to take money out of the banks and system, etc., and they've been buying real estate. I know real estate agents down here. I mean, I get calls at least 3 times a week. I mean, do you want to sell your house? No, no, thank you. But any houses that are basically $1 million and up, they're telling me they're just selling for cash. And that's what the IRS is going after now. But they're not institutions buying it. This is just people just trying to get money off the grid.
When you say East Germany, Germany now, if you move, you have to inform the police what your address is.
True. I mean, they just have to, you know, they're so concerned about civil unrest because they know they have basically screwed up everything. I mean, even in that the interview with Putin, I mean, they did have a peace deal, and they started to sign it, and Boris Johnson got on the plane and said no. You know, it's the U.S. and the West that's interfering, and they want this war. If they tell Ukraine, no peace deals at all. And they could care less about the Ukrainian people. I mean, we had two Ukrainian employees there, one in Donetsk and one in Kiev. They're both now living in Berlin. They've almost 10 million Ukrainians have left the country. It's just being absolutely destroyed. And they could really care less. All they're trying to do is kill as many Russians as they can. And if they wipe out all of Ukraine, well, we'll avenge them. That's basically it. It's got nothing to do with anything that's practical. And war is always the most inflationary aspect of anything.
We have a second question from Steve. Canadian housing prices are 12 times the multiples income compared to 3 to 6 times in the U.S. Does Socrates see these housing markets correcting, and by what percentage?
Yes, they will correct. Canada has been a place where a lot of the foreign money has come in. And when they put in restrictions about foreigners buying property. But, people have been using real estate as a place to put money, to get it out of the banks, which they're beginning to question whether or not, they're safe with CBDCs coming. That's what tends to survive when we go through a currency crisis that we are actually developing here, is the tangible assets. So it's not just gold and silver or it's collectibles, rare coins, rare stamps, real estate, and equity. But the U.S. market is a bigger market and it's much more diverse. So that ratio is certainly different. But, if you look at even Zillow report for 2023 is very interesting, that only 14% of the sales were in New England. Over 40% of all the sales are in the South. So what's really happening is you also have this great migration that's going on, and people are fleeing the blue states to the red states. But the taxes are just outrageous. I moved to Florida 7 years ago, and I can tell you my father's was a lawyer, so his law partner had just joked. He says, while I lived in New Jersey, he says, if you die here, tell your family, drag your body across the river before they tell anybody. They want 50% of your money basically while you're living, and then when you die, they want the other half. It's just crazy. So, and where's that money going? It's just going to their, in their pockets, and the corruption is so high, and nobody gets anything out of it.
Are geopolitics and election fraud likely to be the standout concerns for 2024?
Yes, our computer basically, I think, has been spot on its political forecasts. I mean, back in '85, it came out with a forecast, laid them out. It said 2016 would be the first time a possible third party could win. And that ended up being Trump. I mean, both sides hated him. 2024, it was saying that nobody's going to accept this election, either side. We're going to be looking at a rise in civil unrest. The country is just way too divided anymore. And 2028 may not even take place. I mean, this is the collapse of republic. You're seeing the same sort of thing in Canada. During the question period, they started questioning about, the Nazi that was Trudeau had in there. It just got up and left. I mean, I don't know, 30 years ago, they at least tried to pretend that they were all honest. Today, they don't care.
Aside from election ballot fraud, are there other mechanisms that could rig the 2024 U.S. presidential election?
Well, you have all these crazy arguments, and it's up in the Supreme Court right now. I seriously doubt that they would rule in favor of Colorado against Trump. I mean, but let's just say that they did. You know, how can you then have a federal election when you've taken, you know, one state off, then other states might take them off, and then what kind of election do you have? I mean, you know, you're taking out the major, you know, opponent. I mean, in the Democratic Party, it's so rigged, it's crazy. I mean, they wouldn't allow JFK on the Democratic, you know, ticket, and they're not allowing any competition to Biden whatsoever. I mean, this is a democracy. I mean, we're not, you know, they're trying to prevent us from even having a choice. And, you know, I seriously doubt that the Supreme Court will kick Trump off the ballot. If they do, you're looking at massive civil unrest this summer. I mean, look at what else you're going to do. I mean, you're denying half the country a right to even vote.
What does Socrates see ahead for Canada this year?
It's pretty much the same, that we're looking at really rising discontent against government. However, keep in mind that it is far worse outside North America. All right, Europe is an absolute basket case. Japan is terrible. You just had North Korea come out and said they have an international right to take the South. They're shooting test missiles off over Japan, and we've got clients in Japan like, I better get some money out of here. So you have capital flows coming in from Asia, from the Middle East now, and from Europe, all just trying to park some money in North America. So, I mean, this is part of the issue of real estate, but, you know, you've outlawed a lot of individuals being able to buy real estate in Canada from foreign countries. They still can buy here in the United States, and they're doing so quite rapidly. But it's mainly to get money just in a safe place. They're worried about war over there. You got the election. You have the COVID fraud, which is a major issue over there, because you had Ursula strike a deal with Pfizer, and she never allowed anybody to vote on it, and she has refused to turn over her emails or anything to do with Pfizer. So, I mean, people just don't trust anything anymore.
How widespread and strong do you think the deep state is that wants to take down the U.S., Canada, and the rest of the world?
I don't know if it's the deep state. It's more of the globalists, which are really outside. Those are people like primarily from the World Economic Forum. They're unelected. You got George Soros basically interfering in just about every election he possibly can. His son put out a tweet with a picture of a pane of glass with a bullet hole through it and holding $47 along next to it. That's implying, you know, assassinate Trump, please. These people are just trying to take over the world. There's been this theory along for a long time that if there's one government, then that would end war. There's a tape on my site. You can Google it. Holland was the former president of France, and he's standing there in Parliament with Merkel, and he outright says the whole purpose of the EU was one government will prevent war. And it's nonsense. I mean, they obviously don't know their history. I mean, the Roman Republic was one government, and how many civil wars did they have? So that's basically what you're kind of looking at. It's just we're in the final stages of really the collapse of Republican forms of government, which are historically the most corrupt ever. You can't really even bribe a monarch, but you can bribe Republican forms of government because everybody's up for sale. And that's unfortunately, what we have to face. And hopefully as this materializes and becomes out the other side, we learn from our mistakes this time, and we deal with it. This is why Caesar crossed the Rubicon. People, you know, the fake news back then was Cicero, and Cicero was one of the oligarchs. But if you read everybody else besides Cicero, I mean, when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, all the cities cheered. You know, thank you, you're here to save us. And it was the Senate that fled to Asia. So if the Senate was this great thing and supported by the people, why did they flee? The people were behind Caesar, not behind the Senate.
Has there ever been a soft landing for economies that followed a period of time where there were debt bubbles everywhere?
No, I mean, the problem with the debt that we have now is it's substantially different in that even the head of the Fed, Powell, came out at the beginning of December, and he criticized the Biden administration, said this spending is unsustainable. Now, that went over the heads of most people. I mean, as you know, I've advised central banks around the world. So I've been in meetings, et cetera. You know, I know the rules of the game. They do not criticize their host government, and they do not criticize each other. All right? So when Powell criticized the Biden administration, it was the first time the Federal Reserve has ever done so since 1951. In 51, they broke with the White House because the White House wanted them to do quantitative easing to keep interest rates down during the Korean War, and they refused. So when Powell came out and said that, this is getting to the point it's very dangerous. And what's happening is that, and I've talked to these people for decades. I've warned them how governments fall. And it's when you try to sell the new debt to pay off the old, because it's just a Ponzi scheme. They have no intention of ever paying off the debt anyhow. They just increase it every year. I mean, this year they were looking to spend another $2 trillion. So you have to understand that the big problem we have is Biden is just a placeholder. And I'm not being political by saying this, that the job of the president is to sit in these cabinet meetings, and he is a referee. Biden's not even there 40% of the time, and when he is, it's questionable if he even understands what's going on. All right, so as a result, the big state, as deep state as people call it, are all these agents. There's nobody being a referee. So every one of them is doing their own thing. So you got the climate change people going out and like, oh, okay, fine. Let's outlaw gas stoves. Now the latest one coming out, being directed by the World Economic Forum, people should not be allowed to have a garden in their backyard. And then you have the neocons running the secretary, you know, the State Department. You know, they're out there bashing China over Taiwan. Oh, we're going to come in there. And the idiots don't even understand that China is the largest holder of U.S. debt. They've been selling off debt. Now, if they no longer buy the debt, guess what? That's when interest rates start to rise. The central banks can only control the short term. They cannot control the long term. And if nobody's going to buy the long-term debt, the long-term interest rates will go up. All right, so you have to understand what's going on here. And you can't go bashing China and expect things just to be hunky-dory here. We're looking at that's the source of a debt crisis. And when governments fail, it's when they can no longer sell the new tranche of debt. And when there's no bid, that's when the whole thing comes crashing down.
Is Socrates seeing any panic cycles ahead? And what exactly is Socrates?
Socrates is the only fully functioning AI system really in the world. I designed it basically as an international hedge fund manager. I understood in capital flows, etc. So I put in absolutely everything in there and have it monitor the entire world and come back and tell me which direction it's pointing at now. And it's been phenomenal over the years. That's why we ended up being the biggest institutional advisors anywhere. And it's highlighting this year two key periods. One is May, and the other one is going to be September. These are going to be the two real critical periods. And the rumor on the street is that the neocons are desperate, They are going to try and create some sort of confrontation, some war this year, maybe by July. And the nonsense that they, pat each other on the back telling is that no president's ever lost an election during war. So they want to create this war for the election. They think it will help Biden. And that's kind of really a nonsense. But they also are afraid of Trump. And if Trump were to win and they can't assassinate him or something like that, then they want to make sure there's a war in place that he cannot exit. Because Trump's against the war. He's against CBDCs, he's against climate change, and he's against war. And I was really shocked at the last Davos meeting, you had Jamie Dimon, the head of the largest bank in the U.S., actually for the first time came out and criticized, everybody. He said, listen, Trump was right about the wall, Trump was right about China, and he was right about NATO, which really shocked me because he wanted to exit NATO. NATO needs war. I've seen the internal and the discussions. They're afraid of becoming irrelevant. If peace is there with Russia, then why do you need NATO? All the money that they keep getting from every country would be diverted to something else. So this is a self-interest on NATO's part. They need to keep Russia as an enemy. I published a book, The Plot to Seize Russia, and I got a hold of all the declassified documents from the Clinton administration. And in that interview, with Putin, he said, yes, that he had said to Bill Clinton, can we join NATO? And I've got the documents, and I published it in the book. They had agreed. They were proposing that Russia could join NATO. And that started the whole coup in there against Gorbachev, because the communist hardliners thought that that would be a surrender to the United States. They staged a coup against him. That's when Yeltsin had to stand on the tank. He ended up becoming president, and he begged the troops not to fire on the people, and they didn't. When they didn't, the coup collapsed. But that's what all that stuff was about. And this is why the mainstream media does not want you to listen to Putin's interview. What he said was absolutely true, and I've got the documents in my book that I published. You can get it off of Amazon, The Plot to Seize Russia. And I put in all the declassified documents from the Clinton administration, and what he said in that interview was just the tip of the iceberg.
With higher interest rates, are some interest rate-bearing products safer than others?
Well, you want to stay away from the long term. Short term is much better, because as rates go up, at least you're not locked in. The banks that have gone down, like SVB in California, is because they invested long term. And as interest rates go up, what happens is those long term bonds have to be discounted as if they were paying the current interest rate that far out. So if they raise it 1% and you got a 30-year bond, you're going to lose 1% for, all the way out for 30 years. That's why, Europe is in such a crisis mode with its banks, because they lowered interest rates to negative in 2014 and left them there for nearly 9 years. So all the banks, the reserves that they had to buy these bonds from the government and, by law. So as interest rates are going up, they've lost a fortune.
There's a lot of negativity towards the stock markets. Could a short squeeze take the stock markets significantly higher?
Yes. What you have to understand is that these people, they keep talking about a great crash coming and all this stuff. They don't know anything about history or what even, happened. They just look at 1929, the stock market's up, so it's got to crash. When that took place, the U.S. had a balanced budget, all right? So, yes, you sell the stocks, and you move to a flight to quality, it's called. You ran to the bonds. Even Andrew Mellon, who was Secretary of the, Treasury back then, they had said to him, when do you think the market will stop? And in April of 29, he said, you know, the market will peak when gentlemen prefer bonds. That's the flight to quality he was talking about. Now, ask yourself today, do you really want to sell all your stocks and everything and buy bonds when the government is just spending like a drunken sailor? I wouldn't. And that's why you have people buying real estate and they're putting money everywhere they possibly can. I mean, even, you know, rare coins, rare stamps, all these things are up dramatically. Even, you know, classic cars, like a 1988 Ferrari. You could have bought one for about maybe $80,000, maybe 5 years ago, 4 years ago. They're like $300,000 today.
Do wars cause money printing inflation that leads to higher energy prices, more price inflation, and higher interest rates?
Yes. I mean, I don't, as far as the energy is concerned, it's a real pipe dream with this nonsense that we'll get to net zero. What are you going to do? Take a tank and plug it in? Okay, fine. Can we pause here in war for a minute while we charge up? You know, come on. It's not practical at all. Energy prices will rise. They got no choice but to rise, and these people are just completely bizarre in their thinking process. But war is always far more inflationary. If you print money and it goes even to welfare, the people at least spend the money in domestic economy. When you print money like this and you hand it over to Ukraine, it does nothing at all to stimulate our domestic economy. It's basically a drain on the economy. So it's kind of like hiring a maid to your house. If she bring in income, she just consumes it. This is what war is. And that's why it was the Vietnam War that broke Bretton Woods. They kept printing money and money and money, but the fix to gold remained the same at 35. Obviously, I think a three-year-old with a pocket calculator could have figured out the system was going to fail at some point.
At what point does lower and lower inflation actually become deflation?
It becomes deflation as soon as you end up with basically people contract. What interest rates are really a reflection of inflation for the future. So if you think the stock market's going to double next year, you'll pay 10%. You'll pay 15, 20% interest, all right? But if you don't think it's going to go up 1%, you're not going to pay 1%. You know, it's not the level of interest rate. It's the level of expectation. So whenever you see an economic uncertainty, people contract. They spend less, all right? The whole 2007 to 2009 crisis was the mortgage-backed security problem. When people see that the value of their house is declining, they view that as savings. They automatically stop spending and they save. So that contraction causes the recession. So, you know, the interest rate is really a reflection of the future. And as long as, I mean, we've published studies, you can look at them on our site. Stock markets rise with rising interest rates. They decline with lower rates, all right? They lowered rates in the Great Depression. Stock market fell 90%. They lowered rates 2000 to 2009. The stock market declined. The Fed started raising rates when Trump was elected. Rates went up, stock market went up, and then they called it, oh, well, this is the Trump rally. Then they don't pay attention to the interest rates. They say, as long as you think you're going to make a profit, you'll borrow. But there's got to be an expectation of profits to do so.
Are people saying no thanks to central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, and digital ID, two keys to 15-minute cities?
Yes, I think a lot of people are certainly very upset about the whole nonsense. And this is an agenda that's coming from the World Economic Forum, an unelected body. And I know Klaus Schwab. He is an academic. He has no real practical experience in the world economy. I mean, he's done a great job in building his WEF, but, you know, he does have basically a bust of Lenin on his bookshelf. He is a control freak. The way he runs things, he has to control everything. And he's taking that same attitude and trying to apply it to the world. And his economic theory, and he thinks is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But these 15-minute cities for climate and all that, the whole climate change agenda is nonsense anyhow. I mean, climate has always changed. You can go back. There's ice ages, warming periods, etc. Civilization expands during warming periods and it contracts during cold periods. Part of the decline of the Roman Empire was it turned cold. All right, when it turns cold, people are malnutrition. They get diseases more. You get the plagues that correlate with the climate turning down, and that's what brought in the Huns and the Goths and everybody else because there were droughts and it was too cold. Go back to even further to the Bronze Age, and you'll see that it was. They called them the Sea Peoples. They flooded in from the north. They overthrew every civilization except the Egyptians, all because of climate change. And, this has been going on for a long time. You can Google and find, John Adams, one of the founders of the United States. He wrote a letter to his wife saying he can't even plant anything because the ground's frozen 2 feet deep. I mean, that was the end of basically the 18th century. So it started warming up after that, and these people go, oh, it's all the, we're getting warmer because of the Industrial Revolution. And that's just not the case. That's kind of really nonsense at this point. And so the 15-minute cities, all that is just really a joke, really is a joke.
If the U.S. defaulted on its debt to China, what could China do about it?
Probably nothing. I mean, I would suspect they would default on it, and that's why they're looking for war. If during wartime, they suspend all debt. You can buy all the bonds on eBay. All of Europe defaulted in 1931. Some of them defaulted after World War One, you can buy Asian bonds, South America. They never paid off the debt. This is how routine. It's pretty much routine. You can buy continental currency on eBay from the Constitution of the United States swore that they were going to honor all the debts before. They never did. The people have said, well, gee, maybe if I buy all this debt up now, I can go and force the government to redeem it. No, the court will simply say, well, prove that, we actually defaulted on you. You just bought the stuff on eBay. So they always default. There is only one exception in all of history, and that was Romania that actually paid off its debt. Other than that, U.S. did pay off its debt under Andrew Jackson, and it caused the Panic of 1837 and the sovereign debt default of 1840s.
Are cryptocurrencies a favored vehicle for money laundering, and does this laundering leave a digital trail?
Yes. I mean, look, with the whole thing with the CBDCs, it's unlikely that the Federal Reserve will actually issue a currency. What's going on behind the scenes that nobody wants to talk about yet is that they're going to use the same model they did with COVID. For example, if you read the First Amendment in the United States, it says Congress shall not pass a law to restrict your free speech, religion, etc. All right. So Facebook can, YouTube can. They determine it's only the government that cannot. So the government tells them, would you please censor this guy? So censoring people, debanking them, deplatforming them is all being done by the private sector. So what's happening? The top five banks, I can tell you for sure, are already trying to develop their own currency. All right. The real plot is that the Fed will regulate those currencies. I think Fink is even trying to take over Bitcoin and to convert it into this. And then they can track everything. And the reason the Fed won't do it is because you already have a series of rules and regulations. If you do something suspicious, you came in and you deposited $100,000 in cash, guess what? The bank is supposed to report that to the Treasury. Hey, there's suspicious activity going on here. And they don't tell you, all right? So they're going to use that model for CBDCs. If the currency is actually issued by the bank and regulated by the bank, all right, then the bank will continue to report any suspicious activity to the government. You don't have any constitutional rights that are violated because the constitutional rights only apply if the government does it. So here you're going to have the private sector. It's the same model they use with COVID. The private sector will come down on you. They will be the ones that illegally, immorally, investigate you and then report you to the feds. That's the system they're going to do.
Could Trump's presidential immunity case actually be a boomerang to snare Obama, Biden, Bush Jr., and Clinton for their crimes?
I read that decision from the Court of Appeals. Honestly, you could, by what they did, is saying, okay, fine, yes, he was president, but at that instant, he was acting as a candidate. You can then say that about anybody, including a judge. In my opinion, they have just removed absolute immunity even for prosecutors.
Is 2024 likely to see more experimental medical procedures and increasing excess deaths?
Yes. I mean, honestly, I personally did not get vaccinated. I wouldn't trust anything. Once the government gets involved, I have dealt with them many times, and I would not at all get involved in anything that the government sponsors.
Is there a fine line between depopulation ideologues and mass murderers?
No, I think that, honestly, I mean, this is part of the problem. You can actually look on our site. I had published, Justice Ginsburg. Now, she was a woman's advocate, and she was appointed to the Supreme Court. And when she got there, there was Roe versus Wade, okay, on the abortion thing. And she wrote an article. I mean, I posted it. It was published in the New York Times, that she had said it had nothing to do with women's rights. It was all about, eugenics, to reducing the population. And it was Bill Gates' father who was really the head of Planned Parenthood, and he was sticking these things all in minority areas. Then they told people, it's your right to be able to kill your child or whatever. Oh, yes, okay, fine. It was, it had nothing to do with women's rights. It was all about reducing population, and even Justice Ginsburg came out and said that.
What is the psychological makeup of a globalist?
I think it's this idea that one world government will control it. Schwab has been on the opposite side of the table with me. I've been arguing that, look, we have to stop the borrowing. Government shouldn't be allowed to borrow. And he's on the opposite side saying, look, just default on everybody and we grab more power. And creating these things, just look at like what they did with COVID. I can tell you, absolutely, I swear on my soul, I knew COVID was coming before anybody even heard about it. Schwab was on the phone and made phone calls to people, quote unquote, a virus is coming. All right. And that was, at least 2 months before anybody even heard of it. This whole thing has been planned. It was basically to get control of society, to get us to lock down, and you scare people, you tell them you're going to die, and then look at what they were using it for. Oh, cash is dirty. You might get the virus by handing cash. So all of a sudden you saw a lot of stores, we're not going to accept cash anymore. This was all prearranged for the CBDCs.
What percentage of people do you think are supporters of Marxist ideology? What percentage are proponents of freedom? And what percentage are just sheep?
Well, I think the vast majority of people are sheep. They don't really pay, you know, they know everybody on a sports team, but they don't know anything else, you know. I don't know. Most of the academics that I have met over the years tend to be more on the Marxist side. And what Marx was really doing was saying, look, there's this business cycle, and we have these booms and busts, and we have to eliminate that. And his solution was take everybody's assets. And that's just not correct, all right? The business cycle is driven by everything. Even climate is in there, all right? War is in there. All these things affect it. So, I mean, if it doesn't rain, the price of wheat's going to go up, all right? You can't flatline everything. But, you know, these academics want to create this perfect world. And, you know, when I went to school, I mean, they would say, oh, the business cycle, yeah, there's this business cycle thing, but you can't really predict it. It's irrelevant because government has the power to make everything equal and fair. And all I can say is listen to the speech from the president of Argentina at Davos. He was there and he says, just look at us. We are the example. They were one of the top, you know, five richest countries in the world. They adopted, you know, Marxism, and they fell to number 140. He says it does nothing but, produces poverty.
Where can people buy your new book, The 2024 Outlook, The Year from Political Hell?
They can download it off of our site, and in a PDF version, and it's available there in our store.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Take care up there, Jim.
My guest has been Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, online at armstrongeconomics.com. He was speaking to us from Florida. Coming up, Eric Haddock, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, since early November, you've published your main upside target for stock indexes, and now they're within reach. Can you remind us what they are and how you arrived at them, and do you expect stocks to peak near them?
Yeah, actually, answering that second question first, when these upside price objectives are generated, the main purpose of them is to identify the most likely levels that a market will reach before there's a good chance of a topping process starting to take hold. So just reaching them doesn't automatically signal a top, doesn't automatically generate a sell signal, but it is one of the main objectives needing to be reached before you can start looking for signs of a top. So in that respect, peaking near those levels is certainly possible, but it's not a guarantee just because the markets have gotten to them. With that said, the two primary upside targets, the ones that really have been most in focus and generated the most amount of attention from my readers, the first is in the Dow Industrial Average. And that is right around 39,000 to 39,200. And that upside price objective target was first generated in late 2022 as a 1 to 2 year upside target when the markets had sold off into September of that year, and the Dow in particular was signaling that it should create at least a 6 to 12 month bottom there. At the same time, it was generating this 1 to 2 year upside price target using one of the indicators that I use and that I explain in my work. And it was showing 39,100 approximately as the major upside target for the next move up. Since that time, there have been corroborating wave targets and price objectives, different indicators, some extreme levels that come into play, first on a multi-month basis and more recently on a multi-week basis, that continue to reinforce that target range of 39,000 to 39,200. And now we have the Dow knocking on the door of that that price target. At the same time, the NASDAQ 100 had related upside targets at 17,800 up to 18,200. And this week, the NASDAQ is now entering that target zone. So it has initially fulfilled those upside targets. Perhaps the more important or noteworthy thing to me is that these upside targets are being reached or very very closely approached at the same time that multi-year cycles are favoring at least a 3 to 6 month top, perhaps a larger magnitude top, taking hold in ideally in the January-February 2024 timeframe. So the two of those price objectives and those timing objectives coming together are certainly setting the stage for a very important top in stock indexes, but they have not yet triggered any sell signals or any indication that the top is in. And I think there still is a little bit more upside before we see something like that take hold. In fact, there's some of the secondary indexes like the Russell 2000 that a few weeks ago, after it had pulled back to around 1900, it signaled that it needed to go back up and retest its late December high before a peak would be more likely. So there's these other price patterns and indicators I use that are honing that analysis and narrowing in on when, where, and even how a top is very likely to take hold.
How do you expect energy markets and inflation to impact stocks, and where are we in the inflation cycle?
You've very often had a fairly close correlation between energy markets and the stock market, energy and equities, and often that's a barometer of economic health. When things are going better, you see stocks heading higher, you see energy prices heading higher. I know that's a very simplistic description of that association, but it's also the times when you see some critical divergence where, like in this case, energy markets have already shown that a major top is likely intact, whereas equity markets are still, in many of them, still trying to set new highs. But from a timing perspective, they're both showing that we could see some downturns in March of this year, with each of them having separate downside objectives and cycles where we could see the next lows. But just focusing on inflation and energy, one of the key things I watch is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index as a gauge of that type of inflation. And it's weighted a little more heavily in energy, so it certainly moves in close lockstep with crude oil and the products. And that has that index topped back in 2022 and has been moving steadily lower ever since, even though you have other inflation indexes, particularly the economic ones that the Fed watches, keeping the fear and the threat of inflation alive throughout the last year and a half. But that index has, it showed to me more recently that we should put in a multi-month bottom in mid-December, and that the ensuing or subsequent high from that move would likely come into play in the second half of February, maybe stretching into early March. But you have, along with that, a very consistent 22 to 23-week cycle in crude oil that has timed every significant peak since its June 2022 high. And that 22 to 23-week cycle is coming into back into play next week, February 12th to the 16th, the trading week, and or the week that follows it. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a final spike up in some of the energy markets and at least a 1 to 2 month and potentially longer top set at that time. And that fits with some of the other markets I'm watching too that are showing me we could see something kind of surprise the markets a little bit in the next week or two that triggers some more accelerated moves in a lot of different markets.
Real estate markets in Canada topped in the first half of 2022. Do you have any thoughts on U.S. real estate?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that U.S. real estate, and I've detailed this and described it in some of my monthly newsletters, that it has had a unique 17-year cycle, which is also a cycle that I've written about for 25 years now, and just how uncanny it has been in the stock market, in timing Middle East wars, so some very diverse things, but it's also had a strong impact on interest rates, real estate, and related phenomenon. And in the case of real estate in the U.S., we are in 2023, we were 17 years from the previous peak in real estate in 2006, which had come 17 years from a prior peak in 1989, and there had been another preceding peak in right around 1972. So it's been a very consistent application of this same 17-year cycle. And that cycle has also timed peaks in the Fed funds target rate in third quarter of 2023, potentially, if it holds as the peak, going back in 2006, 1989. And so I do think that you have, you've probably seen the peak in real estate, but like so many things, there's a topping process that takes hold. And you only start to see very subtle signs at first, and then gradually over time that starts to build some, it's reinforced by other factors and starts to become more obvious to the masses.
Also, how long after the top of a real estate cycle are we likely to see a significant waterfall drop?
You know, historically that usually takes a couple years. Most recently in the U.S., at least, you can look at that previous 17-year cycle that I was just discussing. And whereas 2006 was the peak, it wasn't until 08 and 09 when you really saw the sharp sell-off take hold in a lot of real estate. So there certainly is a lag there, and you do need that topping process to unfold usually before you are set up for a more significant sell-off. So that's why I say, too, just because a market has peaked doesn't mean that it's suddenly going to crash. That the peak is just that. It's the highest point that it hits between two lower levels, lower peaks, and so it takes some time before the whole process plays out, where you start to get a recognition of that peak, and then you start to see some of the factors that were driving that peak now starting to weigh on the market. So often you have at least a 1 to 2 year lag between those two phenomena.
We keep hearing the Fed will lower interest rates this year. What are bond market cycles revealing about interest rates for the year?
Well, I probably sound like a broken record with discussion of bonds and interest rates, but there are a few key cycles that I continue to watch in them. And then there's been many corroborating fundamental events and technical events that keep reinforcing those cycles. But the primary one is a very consistent four-year cycle that has timed highs in the bond market, so corresponding lows in interest rates. And over the last decade, that timed peaks in July 2012, July 2016, and then July 2020 was set up for the major peak, which is exactly when bonds did top out. But a subsequent lower high is likely sometime around July 2024, the next phase of that four-year cycle. And even as that four-year cycle unfolded, there has been a consistent 17 to 18-month cycle that last peaked in February of 2023 that also projected a future high in July or August of 2024. There were a host of cycle lows coming into play in October of 2023, and so far that's where bonds bottomed. And for the related rebound that I expected from there, that also targets that July-August 2024 time frame. So there's a strong argument to be made for bonds setting an intra-year high in that time frame right after mid-year. And so that would tell you that most likely, if there's going to be rate cuts, they would probably be leading into that time frame, since the market is often anticipating things and gets ahead of itself. So I think there still is certainly a chance of some rate cuts, but even as we've seen, as each week and each month of economic numbers unfold, that just when traders and economists are convinced that the Fed should start cutting rates within a couple months, all of a sudden a couple more strong numbers hit the market, and that expectation gets pushed back and pushed back. So the amount and the frequency of any rate cuts is still yet to be determined, but I'm watching the broader cycles and when I think we should start looking for that intervening peak in bonds, likely in July or August of this year.
What about the dollar and gold? Do you see them breaking out of their trading ranges anytime soon?
I do think that particularly in gold, there's a growing probability for a breakout to the upside in the not too distant future. The way that gold has been trading over the last 6 months, over the last 1 to 2 years, it has been basically, it created first a double top in March of 2022, and then a triple top in May of 2023, and now in December of last year, more or less a quadruple top. And there's a lot of validity to the old cliche, the old trading cliche of double tops hold, triple tops don't. And what that's really expressing is how markets often evolve. And when a market runs up to a strong resistance point, it will initially turn down, sell off. But then in many cases, a market is able to go back up to that same point and retest it and see if there's any additional buying that traders could generate by maybe spiking above those highs a little bit. And when that doesn't happen, when any additional buying fails to materialize, is when you get a much stronger confirmation of a top and often a larger sell-off from there. In contrast, when a market has set a double top, had a decent correction in between, but then is able to head back up and hit those levels again, that's usually not a top forming. That is usually the start of a new leg up, and it often is going to initially peak at the same levels because that was such a solid resistance point. So in gold, in the front gold futures, we're talking somewhere right around 2070. And so when gold rallied into early May of last year and peaked right around that same point, then it sold off, but its sell-off was shallower than the previous sell-off. Then leading into early December, it ran back up again and even spiked a little bit higher than that 2070 level. And subsequent to that, had an even shallower sell-off. That's more indicative of a market that is building up some upward pressure. It's a little bit like a coiling spring with this weight that keeps being pressed down on the spring, but at some point that weight gets slid off to the side and then a market is able to accelerate higher. And you just have a lot of things in the gold market from a technical perspective, from a cyclical perspective, that are showing we're likely near that point where it could break through to the upside and then see some accelerated buying from there. And that coincides with some of the multi-month and multi-year cycles I'm seeing in the dollar, that the dollar peaked in late 2022 and saw its initial sell-off into July of last year. But I think we're in the process of forming a second decline, and that could stretch later into this year and probably coincide with if and when gold is breaking out to the upside. So I think you are certainly getting closer to those breakouts, particularly in gold. The dollar is a little bit more solidly in the trading range that it's in, and even if it's sold off, it might find support near its previous lows, the lows of the last 6 to 12 months. But I think there are several indications warning of the upside breakout in gold. There's a couple more indicators that I need to kick in before I think it would trigger that run-up. But there are some cycles and some time price indicators that I use that are really honing and zeroing in on the precise time when I think that gold could see that sort of move. And all of these markets together are kind of telling me, you know, maybe we've got some surprise event on the near term horizon. Within the next few months, these indicators are zeroing in on a more specific time, but that you might get some sort of black swan event hitting the markets that really creates some knee-jerk reactive moves, both buying and selling, depending on which market you're talking about, hitting a lot of the financial markets.
How does Bitcoin fit into your outlook?
Bitcoin tends to have its own cycles and own trends and indicators. I've often compared Bitcoin, gold, and the dollar, and on a little bit more broad general perspective, you could then break that down to cryptos versus hard currency versus fiat currencies. But I've compared it to both an algebraic equation, A times B equals C, or a game of rock, paper, scissors, where you often have, of those three, so let's just say the dollar index, gold, and Bitcoin, usually there's room for one of them to be moving in an accelerated fashion while the other two are kind of battling it out. And you'll get that association constantly rotating or alternating. And more recently, what I thought we'd see in Bitcoin, it had already run up to some multi-month upside targets. I had around 48,000 and then sold off into middle of January. But since that time, my work has shown that it should rally up into the exact time frame where we are now, February 9th, February 12th. That two-day period is the most precise synergy of these cycles. Obviously, the market can always stretch a little beyond that, but that we could see another intermediate high in this time frame, but also looking at 3 to 6 month cycles. February is a key time for a multi-month top in cryptos. So it wouldn't surprise me to see a final spike high here in this narrow window of time, and then see the cryptos start to consolidate a bit, opening up the potential for gold to start experiencing a bit stronger rally. So like I said, you get this back and forth interplay between the three of them, and most recently Bitcoin's been the one benefiting and seeing a nice strong rally, but I think that it could set an intermediate top pretty soon, and then you would probably see gold and the dollar start to move a little bit more significantly in opposite directions.
Where can listeners get more information on Inside Track and the Weekly Relay?
Best place is at our primary website, insidetracktrading.com, and that is inside with the extra I in the middle. So it's INSIIDE, tracktrading.com.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He was speaking to us from California. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Armstrong, and Eric Haddock. If you have any questions for our guests or the show, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.